Hey, thanks for checking out the Roots of Rock podcast edition for January 2018. Had to think about that for a second and not say 2017. It's going to take a little while, right? I hope you had a great Christmas and a happy new year. I was on holidays for the last part of December and early January, so rather than try to cram something in for the end of the month, I thought I would use one of the old episodes and produce it as a podcast for you since I have a backlog of those. This episode that you're about to listen to actually aired at the end of 2016. So I make a couple references to things like David Bowie's death and whatnot in the episode. Just wanted to give you a reference for the time frame that this was recorded in so you weren't confused. Anyway, enjoy the show.
It all starts with a root.
Oh, Johnny, go.
An organism.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
A living, breathing feeling. A being that comes to life. This living, breathing being is rock and roll. And this is Roots of Rock, podcast edition. Here's your host, John Tompkins.
On September 5th, 1946, Farouk Balsara was born in Stonetown in the Sultanate of Zanzibar, which is now known as Tanzania. Farouk's parents were Parsis, originally from India. The family soon sent Farouk back to India to attend boarding school. It was there that he began to take piano lessons at the age of 7. As he reached adolescence, he began to form bands in school. They did a lot of rock and roll covers and loved guys like Little Richard. As Farouk grew a bit older, he decided he would go by the name Freddie. Well, Freddie moved to England with his family at the age of 17 after some political unrest in Zanzibar. He enrolled at a polytechnic shortly thereafter where he began to study art. He earned his diploma in art and design, which would come in handy later on in life. After earning his diploma, Freddie joined a series of bands and floated through odd jobs until he joined up with a couple of guys by the names of Brian May and Roger Taylor. Both of those guys played in a band called Smile. May played guitar and Taylor played drums. When Freddie Balsara joined the band, he convinced the other two that they should change the name of the band. So if you didn't know the backstory of this band already, have you guessed who they are? Would it help if I said that Freddie Balsara changed his last name to Mercury? That's right, we're talking about the one and only Queen. That formation and name change happened in 1970. John Deacon, who had played bass in the band, was recruited around 1973 prior to recording their debut album. That debut album was recorded at Trident Studios in England. Since Queen was not yet an established band, they were only allowed to record during the studio's downtime after the paying artists had left. That meant that the band was usually recording between 3 and 7 a.m. That's dedication! They finished the album in November of 1972. Trident Studios spent months trying to get a record company to release it. After 8 months and no takers, Trident just decided to do it themselves. The album made it to the charts and had some critical success. In retrospect, many rock and roll institutions have rated it as a must-have album. But it wasn't necessarily a breakout album in the beginning. And that doesn't take away from it, it's still a great album. So let's hear from it now. Here's Great King Rat by Queen. Great King Rat by Queen. Written by Freddie Mercury, that song showcased some of the aspects that Queen would come to be known for, like Freddie's powerful voice, May's blistering solos, and sudden tempo changes. May's solo featured a wah pedal, and many people classified them as a psychedelic band because of that particular sound. They had a bit of a Zeppelin thing going on that early album as well. On the inner sleeve of the album, the band included a comment that nobody played a synthesizer, which was a bit of a purist principle from Brian May, and he wanted to make sure that everyone knew that no one was playing a synthesizer on the album. And you know what? It occurs to me that I mentioned the album sleeve, and there's a whole generation, or maybe even multiple generations, that may not even know what a record sleeve is. How strange is that? Any of you out there listening who may not be familiar with what that is, I suggest you just Google it. Queen is from a time when you had to care enough about a band and music to go out and search for a record. You had to buy it and hold it in your hands. And when you brought it home and played it, it wasn't just music. That was a massive part of it, obviously. But the album sleeve was like an inside look at the band and the people that had created this amazing music that you fully were enveloped by. And that classic Queen logo that we all know? Freddie Mercury put his art and design diploma to work and designed that himself. Let's hear them again. This time, let's hear from their third album, Sheer Heart Attack. This album was the one that propelled them into the mainstream. It was released in November of 1974 by EMI in the UK and Elektra in the States. Let's do the first single off that album. Here's Killer Queen.
She's a killer queen, gunpowder gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind.
Who doesn't love a song about a high-class escort? That song marked a bit of a change of direction for Queen. It was the first time they really ventured into a more radio-friendly sound. It featured some pretty heavy-duty four-part harmonies, which they combined with some classic rock guitar solos, creating a real power pop kind of sound for the band. Freddie was really showing off his range of voice in that one as well. It was also their first big breakthrough hit. Both Brian May and Freddie Mercury have said that after writing and recording this song, they felt that they had established their sound as a band. Now, I would be remiss if I did a show focusing on a great band like Queen and I didn't include one of the most unique and catchiest songs I've ever heard in my life. Bohemian Rhapsody, one of the most singable songs ever. I always thought that I was getting the lyrics wrong when I was singing along, but it turns out I had it right. I was just singing the phonetics, thinking that he couldn't be saying Bismillah, but he was. Bismillah is actually the opening line in the Quran and means in the name of God, the most gracious, in Arabic. And Scaramouche? Apparently the name of a stock clown character from 16th century Italian comedies. Who knew? I literally used to think that the lyrics just had a bunch of nonsensical words thrown in together that sounded cool. And Freddie Mercury himself has sort of said as much in interviews, but many people have speculated on the meaning of the lyrics. The band has always wanted to allow listeners to interpret the song in their own personal way, but they also said that they had agreed as a band to keep Freddie's personal meaning out of the song with respect to him. So there obviously is some deeper meaning that the band is keeping to themselves, and I'm not going to speculate here because there are a lot of different theories. We'll just enjoy it for what it is, a masterpiece, completely unique from anything before or since. I would argue if you don't like this song, you probably don't like music.
Will you do the bandango?
Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo,
Galileo Figaro.
Magnifico!
Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. Man, that song puts a smile on my face. The first time I ever heard it was when I watched the first Wayne's World and the guys were rocking out in the Mirthmobile. Remember that scene? Classic. And I also remember my parents shaking their heads that was how I discovered the song. But I wasn't the only one. When that song was first released in 1976, it reached the top of the UK singles chart and stayed there for 9 weeks. But when it was featured in Wayne's World in 1992, it hit the US and reached number 2, only to be outperformed by the song Jump by Criss Cross. The production of that song was an incredible feat in itself. There were so many vocals overdubbed onto the 24-track tape machine used to record it that Brian May has said that the tape actually was see-through. They did over 180 layered tracks. The song was close to 6 minutes long, which was considered to be way too long to be a radio hit. And there's actually a version out there that has the operatic sections of the song removed. What kind of a travesty would that be? Those parts make the song! Stick around and we're going to get into who influenced Queen in the next segment coming up. I'm Sean Tompkins and this is Roots of Rock.
You're listening to Roots of Rock, podcast edition.
I'm Sean Tompkins. Welcome back to Roots of Rock. Queen was massively influential on a lot of bands. We all know that. But who influenced them? Who did they draw from? One artist that's top of mind right now is David Bowie. Bowie's recent death has really accentuated his influence on the musical world. He was groundbreaking in a whole new way in his time, and really throughout his entire career. His first self-titled album was released in 1967, but it was the game-changing Space Oddity album that was released in 1969, 3 or 4 years before Queen's first album. That was the one that really made it possible for bands to imagine and to pull off things they'd never thought possible. And so I think it's really viable to include it in a list of Queen's influences. Space Oddity by The Thin White Duke. That song is actually charting again since the announcement of Bowie's death, by the way. So were 19 of his albums. That's right, there are 19 Bowie albums on the UK Top 100 charts right now. That line about the papers want to know whose shirts you wear? Whose shirt you wear is actually British slang for which football team you're a fan of. So in this song, I guess Bowie's saying that once you get to space, your opinion on which is the best football team somehow begins to matter. In 2008, Jimmy Page claimed that he may have been the one to show David Bowie the chords in this song. And I think he was only half joking. Page was a session musician in the old days and had worked a few times with Bowie in some of Bowie's previous bands. He says that he had shown Bowie the chords that he actually used to write Space Oddity. Kind of a cool little tie-in. Anyway, the chords are kind of a little odd and unique at the start, and alone they sound a little strange, but all together, they really sound great, and the song is obviously a masterpiece. So who else influenced Queen? There's definitely some of the great songwriting from the Beatles in there, and Freddie's singing was influenced by the likes of Robert Plant on the rock side, and even artists like Aretha Franklin. And can't you just hear Elvis singing a song like Crazy Little Thing Called Love? But they really did pick up where bands like Led Zeppelin and The Who left off. So let's get into The Who today. The Who were formed in 1964. The classic lineup of singer Roger Daltrey, guitarist Pete Townshend, bassist John Entwistle, and the infamous Keith Moon on drums. The band has charted 27 top 40 singles in the UK and United States, as well as 17 top albums with 18 gold, 12 platinum, and 5 multi-platinum awards in the United States alone, and so are considered one of the most influential rock bands of all time. I mean, these are the guys that basically invented the Marshall stack and smashing your instruments at the end of a gig. Let's go to their Tommy album first. This is The Who's fourth studio album. It was a double album released in 1969. It was one of, if not the first, rock opera ever written. So it really is appropriate to name it as an influence on Queen. This album has gone on to be produced by a Seattle opera company, made into an orchestral version, a film in 1975, and even a Broadway musical. And the album alone, by The Who, has sold more than 20 million copies. Now, usually we'd think of Pinball Wizard when we think of this one, so let's do something a little different. Let's go with Go to the Mirror, by The Who.
See me, feel me, touch me.
The Who with Go to the Mirror. Here's a cool tie-in. In 2006, The Who were awarded the Freddie Mercury Lifetime Achievement Award at the Live Music Awards. Brian May and Roger Taylor were the presenters. How cool is that, that everything kind of came full circle? All the guys from The Who sort of grew up in the same town in England and were in various bands in their teenage years together and eventually discovered rock and roll and went on to form The Who. They didn't have a drummer at the beginning, so they started auditioning replacements. The legend goes that Keith Moon broke a bass drum pedal on his audition and tore a drum skin because he played so hard. The band quickly figured out that the audiences loved it when they destroyed a stage and their instruments and began to work it right into their act. By 1964, The Who were becoming pretty popular in London. They attracted the attention of a guy named Shel Talmy, a legendary producer who had produced The Kinks. He subsequently signed The Who to a record deal. They cut a couple of singles, the first of which was called I Can't Explain. The B-side on that song was called Bald-Headed Woman. And guess who played on that one? Jimmy Page. That guy was everywhere in those days. But the first big breakout hit by The Who was the single My Generation.
People try to burst it down.
Talking about my generation,
just because we get around.
Talking about my generation,
things they do look awful.
Talking about my generation,
I hope I die before I get old.
That is an influential rock and roll song, my friends. My Generation by The Who. Townsend wrote that song on a train and was inspired by the Queen Mother, who was alleged had Townsend's 1935 hearse towed off a street in Belgravia because she was offended by it during her daily drive through the neighborhood. This song was the ultimate in youthful rebellion. It contained that cool stutter that made you think they were going to tell everyone to well, you know, you could fill in the blanks, right? It contains that infamous line, "I hope I die before I get old." Well, Pete Townsend is 71 right now. Roger Daltrey, 72. In an interview a while back, Pete Townsend said that when he wrote that song, old meant rich, very rich to him. I think he easily qualifies for both categories now, don't you? When the song was originally written, it was a really slow blues kind of song without those stutters. But Townsend was inspired by John Lee Hooker's stuttering blues song. So they reworked My Generation and added in the stutters, sped it up and made it a rock and roll song, obviously. Let's hear that John Lee Hooker song. Here he is with stuttering blues.
You so look good to me. Give me your address. I'll make a special trip to see you. You have a phone number?
Stuttering Blues by John Lee Hooker. Such a cool song. And you can really hear that The Who emulated it in My Generation. John Lee Hooker was a monster force as far as influences in the world of rock and roll goes. His songs have been covered by an unbelievable amount of artists in the who's who of the rock and roll world. Cream, AC/DC, ZZ Top, Led Zeppelin, Hendrix, The Boss, George Thorogood, you name it, they've covered them. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear a bit more from John Lee Hooker and dig a little deeper into his music. I'm Sean Tompkins, and this is Roots of Rock.
Roots of Rock with Sean Tompkins. Podcast edition.
Hi, I'm Sean Tompkins. Welcome back to Roots of Rock. We started this show with Queen. From them, we went to Bowie and then to The Who. From The Who, we ended up at the song My Generation and then on to John Lee Hooker. Born in 1917, John Lee Hooker was the son of a sharecropper. In his early days, he was only allowed to listen to religious music and would sing spiritual songs in church. Early on, his parents separated and his mom remarried a guy by the name of William Moore, who was a blues singer. It was Moore that John Lee credited with teaching him his distinctive style. John Lee ran away from home and headed for Memphis, Tennessee in the 1930s and would work on the now famous Beale Street. He eventually made his way to Detroit and began playing clubs in the Hastings Street area. He found that his acoustic guitar wasn't cutting through the noise of the clubs and quickly switched to an electric because he was able to amplify it. In 1991, John Lee was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But back then, his first hit was a song called Boogie Chillin'. This is one of those songs. One of those ones that a guy like Sam Phillips was looking for when he recruited Elvis. This is just on the brink of rock and roll. It's toe-tapping stuff. Recorded in 1948, here's John Lee Hooker with Boogie Chillin'.
When I first come to town, people, I was walking down Hastings Street. I heard everybody talking about the Henry Swain Club.
Boogie Chillin' by John Lee Hooker, a classic precursor to rock and roll. Now, John Lee was one of the first guys to popularize electrified blues, which was a direct push on the rock and roll end of things. It had been mostly sort of acoustic style blues up until that point, maybe changed a little bit earlier, but the point is, it was the electric guitar that really changed everything and allowed rock and roll to happen. And it all came about because guitarists were sick of not being heard when they were playing in their band, so it was one of the first ones to be electrified. Acoustics couldn't keep up to the horn sections, and all the other stringed instruments had bows and were typically much bigger, and there were more of them, so they were naturally louder. I'm going to post a video on the Rock Facebook page with a couple of guys showing and describing the world's first electric guitar. It's pretty cool. It's the prototype that made it possible for a guy like John Lee Hooker to amplify his blues and in turn pass the torch onto the rock and roll guys that made the music we know and love today that ultimately ended up in the hands of the guys like Queen and Bowie. I'm Sean Tompkins and this is Roots of Rock. Thanks for joining me tonight. This was fun. Let's do it again.